Welcome to the fourth edition of Under the Weather, Climate Change Research and Justice, a monthly lecture series brought to you by CKUT, the McGill Sustainability Projects Fund, and Climate Justice Montreal. Last term, we heard from different climate justice organizers from across Canada and the United States. This term, the focus is on research. How does one research and test processes that are happening over the long term? And what happens to this research once it is published? What effect does the research ultimately have on society? We hope to have these questions and many others answered over the next few months. Each talk is broadcasted live on CKUT's airwaves at 90.3 FM or online at ckut.ca and will be uploaded in a podcast format shortly after. For more information on our past speakers and upcoming events, please visit undertheweather.ckut.ca. Tonight, I am very excited to introduce our speaker, Dr. Timothy Merlis, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences here at McGill University. Dr. Merlis earned his PhD in Environmental Science and Engineering at the California Institute of Technology and was a postdoctoral fellow at the Princeton University Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. His research focuses on modeling climate dynamics, ocean atmosphere circulation, and hurricanes. Please welcome Dr. Timothy Merlis.
Thank you, Irene, for the nice introduction. So I'm a professor here at McGill, and I teach and do research about the physical climate system. In particular, I focus on the large-scale atmospheric circulation, tropical cyclones, and the climate sensitivity, that is, the amount of global warming in response to CO2. So I'm going to talk mostly about the physical science of climate change, and I'll touch briefly on what the role of people like myself might be in terms of the public debate and the debate with policymakers about what to do about climate change. But I would like to start with basic facts about the science of climate change, and I'll focus on how our scientific understanding develops and what is the use of climate models as a research methodology and why this is a challenging scientific question. So some of this may be review for some in the audience. But I think it's important to state unambiguously that carbon dioxide has risen substantially over the last century. This is the result of industrial activity. The anthropogenic carbon dioxide is emitted as a byproduct of fossil fuel emissions. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is now 400 parts per million, whereas before the Industrial Revolution, it was about 270 parts per million. So we're roughly halfway to a doubling of the amount of CO2 in the air. CO2 is a small fraction of the total gas in the atmosphere, but it has a substantial impact on climate. The global surface temperature has warmed by about 1 degree Celsius over the past century. As an aside, you know, if I was giving this talk in the U.S., I would have to convert that to Fahrenheit, but you know, I'm going to skip that because you're all so advanced. So this 1 degree of warming has happened more or less rapidly over the decades of the century. And indeed, one can find 10-year periods where the climate has cooled modestly, but there's an unambiguous long-term warming trend. And these two things, the anthropogenic emission of carbon dioxide and global surface temperature, are directly connected. It's been known since the mid-19th century that carbon dioxide absorbs radiation emitted by Earth. John Tyndall in the UK did laboratory experiments that measured this effect. We call gases that absorb Earth's radiation greenhouse gases. The atmospheric greenhouse effect comes from radiation being absorbed by the atmosphere and then re-emitted and warming the surface. All else equal, adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere will warm the planet. So I want to pause here and emphasize that what I'm describing is the scientific consensus, but actually these basic facts are more than the consensus within the climate change research community. None of the prominent climate change deniers, often referred to as climate skeptics, dispute these facts. So these dissenting voices that the media often focuses on do not dispute what I have just said. The basic physical principles underlying the increase in temperature in response to increased greenhouse gas concentration were understood in the 19th and early 20th century. Quantitative predictions resembling those we make today emerged in the 1960s. I focused on global average surface temperature, And one reason for this is that it's less noisy. As you know, the weather's fluctuating all the time. Some places are warmer than average, some places are cooler than average on a given day or a given month, or even for an entire year. So the global warming signal will not necessarily be apparent at every weather station, even when averaged over a decade. Beyond the merits of considering the global temperature as a way of isolating changes, removing some of the noise, it's a relevant quantity because many aspects of climate change are proportional to that global average surface temperature change. So the global average surface temperature change is a useful index for other climate changes that you might care about. The connection between CO2 and temperature is clear, but other factors affect surface temperature. So in addition to weather fluctuations, already mentioned, there are longer timescale natural climate variations like the El Niño-Southern Oscillation of the ocean associated with changes in the ocean circulation. There are also other climate-forcing agents, both natural and anthropogenic. So one example that I've researched is volcanic eruptions. Large volcanic eruptions, such as the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, can eject sulfur into the stratosphere, which then turns suspended particles into suspended particles called aerosols. So the sulfate aerosols or sulfur aerosols in the stratosphere reflect sunlight and lead to a temporary cooling of the globe. Carefully examining this kind of observed climate change plays an important role in evaluating in climate research. One can use them as a test for climate models, and one can try and determine what constraints these observed events place on future CO2 warming. And it's the latter that I've studied. So the observed global surface temperature is a combination of various factors, anthropogenic CO2 emission, natural changes such as volcanic eruptions, long-term variations in the ocean circulation. And because it's a combination of factors that affect this observed temperature record, precisely assigning amount of warming to human activity is challenging. I can't tell you humans have caused precisely 72% of the observed 1 Kelvin or 1 Celsius of warming. But the scientific consensus is that more than half of the observed increase in the global average surface temperature from 1951 to 2010 was caused by the anthropogenic increase in greenhouse gas concentrations and other anthropogenic forcings. An important uncertainty in future climate projections is that the magnitude of the warming is not well constrained. So existing climate model projections of future warming differ by about a factor of 2. Over the course of the next century. In addition, there's dependence on what the future trajectory of emissions is. So I'll return to climate models and the source of this uncertainty shortly. And I want to say that, of course, climate is more than just one number, the global surface temperature. We all live on land, and in fact, the land has warmed substantially more than the ocean, about 1.5 degrees Celsius over the last century, as opposed to 1 degree Celsius. And it's projected to continue warming at a much more rapid rate, about 50% more rapid in climate model projections. And, of course, it's not just temperature local that we're interested in. We're interested in things like tropical cyclones and Arctic sea ice, how they change. So I'd like to sort of do a recap by saying, you know, how do we know the science of climate change? In this overview, I've kind of briefly gone through several different ways in which we learn about Earth's climate. One is, you know, the direct measurement of carbon dioxide, which shows this rapid increase. There's other indirect measurements that go back further in time, like analyzing the composition of gas bubbles in ice cores that establish that this is increase in carbon dioxide as part of a longer-term trend dating to the Industrial Revolution. And the observed surface temperature is formed by averaging together weather station observations of temperature. And so these highlight sort of the observational or empirical evidence for global warming. Another way that we develop knowledge is through laboratory experiments like those that John Tyndall conducted in the 19th century, which demonstrated CO2 absorbs radiation. And similar laboratory research continues to this day to refine our knowledge about how molecules absorb radiation emitted by the atmosphere. So the interaction, beyond this laboratory or observational evidence, there's theoretical evidence. So the knowledge of the interaction of light with molecules, what we call radiative transfer, is a well-established branch of physics with a substantial body of theory. So here I'm using the word theory in the scientific sense, something we understand the fundamental underpinnings of, with, you know, something that's withstood substantial scrutiny. I don't mean theory in the colloquial sense, you know, something that's just conjectured. So other fundamental physical principles from chemistry and physics form the basis of our knowledge of climate change. One example being the air's ability to hold more water as temperature rises. So the physical theory behind global warming, the atmospheric greenhouse, and carbon dioxide as greenhouse gas, allowed for Svante Arrhenius, a Swedish scientist, to predict that warming would occur in response to rise in CO2 at the beginning of the 20th century, so like a 100-year-old prediction. And this is well before there was an observable global mean temperature change. Last source of knowledge that I covered is the climate models. So climate models are a key source of information. Computer simulation is a key tool. And when the evidence from observation, computer simulation, and theory align, we have confidence in our knowledge about climate change. When one of these streams of evidence doesn't align, there's a need for further inquiry. Is there an error in how the observations have been analyzed? For example, has a long-term drift in a satellite's orbit not been accounted for? Or is there a missing process in climate simulation? For example, is there a missing interaction between cumulus convection and the humidity of the upper atmosphere? So while keeping in mind that there are many open research questions about climate change, I want to emphasize one more time, it's unambiguous anthropogenic emission of CO2 warms the Earth. I've mentioned several times climate models. What is a climate model? This is a research tool that I use a lot in my work, almost exclusively, actually. So I'm referring to global climate models, which simulate the ocean, atmosphere, sea ice, and land surface. And these are physical models, in contrast to statistical models, where you use an observed relationship between variables to extrapolate. Like, if it rains this much, the temperature changes by that much. That's a statistical relationship. A climate model is a physical model. The necessity of using climate simulation is that, of course, there's only one Earth, and we only have observations of one century of climate change, so we can't do controlled laboratory-style experiments with Earth's climate to isolate one factor or another. Instead, our laboratory is a computational one. We use computer simulation of the climate to answer these kind of what-if questions or isolate one factor over another. The starting point of a climate model is the physical laws that govern radiative transfer, the absorption and reflection of sunlight, and the emission and absorption of radiation by the Earth's surface and atmosphere, and the fluid motion of the atmosphere and ocean. Newton's second law, F equals ma, applied to these rotating fluids. So there's no dispute about these equations or this starting point for a climate model. The challenging aspect is that no one can solve these equations by hand, so we have to use a computer. And using a computer requires breaking the world up into a set of finite boxes. And even though some of the world's largest computers, supercomputers, are used for climate simulations, the typical horizontal scale of these boxes that the world is broken up into is about 100 kilometers horizontally. As you know from firsthand experience, there are important processes in the climate that occur on scales smaller than 100 kilometers. During days when it's partly cloudy in Montreal, it'll be slightly chillier when you have a cloud overhead than when the sun is shining directly on you. So clouds are reflecting some of the sunlight. This affects the global climate in an analogous way. Another critical process occurring on small scales is cumulus convection, thunderstorms. So these effects, the effects of these small-scale processes, smaller than that 100-kilometer scale, must be taken into account in the climate simulation without explicitly simulating them. And that's the challenge of climate modeling. So there's several international climate modeling centers around the world, and these centers make different choices about how to represent the small-scale processes like cloudiness. And we can't necessarily say who's done it correctly in advance. So the projections disagree for the future, but often agree well for the current climate. And this is really like the fundamental challenge of climate science research, is that we cannot test climate models on the timescale of interest. We care about the coming century, and it would be too late if we waited to see which climate model was correct in predicting that. But there are other tests available. For example, climate models are thoroughly comparative against observations of today's climate, such as the mean temperature of precipitation, and their ability to simulate year-to-year variations like the El Niño-Southern Oscillation is a test. So climate models are formulated in the same way as weather prediction models, and weather prediction models can be tested. And they generally have similar successes. For example, both simulate reasonably the evolution of large-scale cyclones that lead to the major winter storms in North America, the snowstorms, and have similar deficiencies. So some of the detailed behavior of summertime cumulus convection in North America is not well simulated by either weather prediction or climate models. But weather prediction does have this advantage that the forecast can be compared to observation, and it's clear when the prediction has improved. It's also interesting to do a sort of historical analysis and look how the early climate forecasts or climate projections have fared. So in 1988, James Hansen presented climate model projections to the United States Congress. And here we are 25 years later, and we can see how these early projections panned out. One difficulty with a direct comparison between observations and these early climate model forecasts is that the amount of warming depends on the trajectory of emissions. More CO2 emissions leads to more warming. But this is a question that's outside the realm of physical science. Imagine trying to make a prediction in 1988, before the end of the Cold War, about the future economy of the world and how energy efficient or inefficient it would be. Nevertheless, the early climate model simulations presented by Hansen in 1988 predicted significant warming in the 90s and 2000s, which was observed. And the climate model simulation clearly outperformed a sort of no warming null hypothesis. Okay, so I'd like to touch a little bit about how physical science influences policy. One thing that we do as scientists is just try and educate the public about the state of knowledge. So thank you for this opportunity tonight. Another way that science intervenes in policy is through the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Assessment Reports, the IPCC reports. So the IPCC has issued assessment reports about climate change every 5 or 6 years since 1990. These reports include several parts. One part covers the physical basis for climate change. Another section covers the risks to society or natural systems associated with climate change. And one section covers mitigation options for climate change. These are really lengthy reports. The fifth assessment's just the physical component, physical basis for climate change, is over 1,000 pages long, covers vast peer-reviewed literature on the topic, but also includes a sort of condensed version, a summary for policymakers, which is designed to be approachable for politicians. So the IPCC report is this really Herculean task of sort of aggregating all of the published literature on the topic and coming up with a consensus. And it's sometimes criticized because the assessments are by nature retrospective, and one can argue that the consensus is conservative. So while I think both of these points are true, it's not clear that there's a better alternative. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about tropical cyclones and climate change as this kind of example to illustrate this difficulty. So tropical cyclones and climate change, it's a sort of big topic, gets a lot of attention. And the scientific community is confident about a number of things. That the maximum wind speed in the strongest tropical cyclones will increase under warming. This is because the energy source of the storms comes from the warm surface waters of the tropical ocean. This reservoir of energy will increase as the climate warms. And like the winds, the rainfall in tropical cyclones will also increase under warmer conditions. This is a consequence of the fact that I mentioned earlier, air will become more humid as the climate warms. The rain comes from this humidity condensing out of the atmosphere. Storm surge in landfalling tropical cyclones, which can be one of the most severe impacts, will also increase under climate change. As the ocean warms, the sea level rises because the seawater expands. So that even if the tropical cyclone winds didn't change, the storm surge would increase because of the higher sea level. So I've covered the maximum wind speed, the rainfall, and storm surge of tropical cyclones and how those will increase under global warming. But there's uncertainty about whether climate change will lead to more or less in the number of tropical cyclones. A consensus has emerged, or has been emerging over the last 5 years, that the number of tropical cyclones globally will decrease. So based on peer-reviewed literature, a World Meteorological Organization working group assessment stated, existing modeling studies consistently project a decrease in the globally average frequency of tropical cyclones, the number, over the course of the 21st century. And the latest IPCC assessment released in September 2013 said something similar. It is likely that the frequency of tropical cyclones, the global frequency, will either decrease or remain essentially unchanged. There's still a lot of uncertainty about the individual ocean basins. So the Atlantic may have more or less tropical cyclones, and the Pacific may have more or less. But the consensus exists for the global number. So these two... this report was issued in September, but two publications came out in September, or in the summer of 2013, one in July and one in August. And here are two quotes from the abstract. So this is a little update. The first one is, the frequency of downscale tropical cyclones increases during the 21st century in most locations. The second quote from an abstract, in this idealized configuration, hurricane frequency increases in response to radiatively forced warming. One of these papers was written by the most prominent researcher in tropical cyclones, Carrie Emanuel of MIT, and the other was written by me. Both were published just before the IPCC report was released, so couldn't be included. And maybe these two papers do not overturn that consensus statement established from the previous peer-reviewed literature. But it's not clear to me that we can confidently rule out an increase in the number of tropical cyclones under global warming. As an aside, I began researching tropical cyclones with the intent of explaining or understanding the physical mechanism underlying what seemed to be a robust projection for less number of tropical cyclones. So the IPCC report and its process is by necessity a sort of snapshot of the state of research in time. The scientific knowledge sort of plows on independent of that process, and what used to be the conventional wisdom may be overturned. A lot of discussions of the effect of climate change on tropical cyclones occur, in terms of the public discussions, in the aftermath of a particular storm. Like last year's Typhoon Haiyan, which had catastrophic consequences in the Philippines. So as a result, a lot of the public discussion is focused on the attribution of a single extreme event, one tropical cyclone. That's the question a journalist likes to ask, you know, did global warming cause this particular storm? But that is a very challenging scientific question. Basically, it's out of the realm of our current ability to do that, to say one storm is caused by global warming. So that's a difficulty, even though we know that on average, in general, global warming will affect tropical cyclones in some well-known ways. So these are rare events with dramatic consequences. And of course, they're subject to those same natural variations that other aspects of the climate are subject to. And they're only about 90 per year, so it's a very rare event. And it's not easy to detect changes in them because oftentimes they'll destroy the weather station in their path. So how should society cope with this scientific uncertainty? I'd like to quote a climate scientist named Adam Sobel on this question. He wrote, "If the time comes that we can detect the warming signal in cyclone activity well enough to make definitive statements, it will be because the storms have intensified to a frightening degree." Basically, a corollary to that, how I would put it, is that there's some experiments that are better to do in a climate model, in a climate simulation, than to do in the real world. I'm going to stop here. Thanks for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.